Welcome to Books, Films, Tilly. This is your host, Tilly, and today I'm going to be discussing the film adaptation of The School for Good and Evil by Soman Chainani. I hope you enjoy. First of all, hi, first episode, I'm finally doing this. As I previously mentioned, my name is Tilly. Every 2 weeks, I'll be discussing film or television series adaptations of books. Which one is better out of the two, whether it is a good adaptation, as well as what I would have done differently. This is not an essay I'm reading into a mic, so bear with me if I go off track a little. It's important to say that a good book-to-screen adaptation doesn't need to be a direct replica of the book, and the structure doesn't need to be the same, nor does the plot, and the characters can be modified. However, in my opinion, the adaptation has to, in some way, do the book justice. The film should demonstrate a certain understanding of the book, of its tone, its characters, its message. While it might seem like most books are better than their adapted counterparts, I can assure you that that's not the case, and I won't be subjecting you to hour-long episodes of me just trashing every adaptation ever done. I won't always be alone as well, hopefully. In the weeks I'm not specifically discussing book adaptations, I'll be having people on the show to talk about a book and a film. I haven't quite decided yet if limited series are allowed, of our choosing. A large part of this is subjective, of course, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. The podcast's social media platforms will be linked in the description. I'd also like to add that for those of you who would like to have some context, I'm going to try and let you guys know what I'll be discussing a few days in advance, hopefully at least a week in advance if I get myself properly organized, which should give you enough time to read the book, but at the very least enough time to watch the adaptation, which is probably the most important one out of the two for you to understand what I'm saying. Otherwise, you can always tune in simply to look for recommendations. I won't be spoiling anything without warning. Or you can always tune in to listen in and have a bit of book, TV, film orientated company. Right, now that's out of the way. Today I'm going to be discussing the Netflix adaptation of The School for Good and Evil by Soman Chainani. First things first, I know I promised that film and television adaptations can be better than their source material, but I'm afraid that this film isn't the case. The book largely trumps the film. However, the reason why the book is better than the film is almost exactly why this isn't a particularly well done adaptation. So it kind of works together. Here's the blow. So every 4 years, two children are stolen from Gavaldon, never to return. Most children fear being taken to the school for good and evil, but not Sophie. She has dreamt all of her life of being a princess and believes the school could be her chance. Her best friend Agatha has other ideas. When the two girls are taken, things don't quite go to Sophie's plan because sometimes the princess and the witch don't look like they do in the fairy tales. So, as you can probably guess from that blurb, this is high fantasy teetering between 9 to 12 and young adult, and like age category wise. It's great. The fantasy elements are well constructed without being overcomplicated. The characters act well in accordance to their age. The plot holds, and not only are the main characters nicely fleshed out, so are the side characters, which is really nice. It all slots in very well together with a couple of really nicely developed lessons and moral questions inserted in the plot as well. It's really enjoyable too. It's made for a younger audience, so despite being almost 500 pages long, it's quite fast-paced without that hindering the structure of the book, and it's also quite funny without being cringy. For you book readers who dislike romance in books, there is an obvious romance subplot, mainly because this book revolves around the making of fairy tale characters and fairy tale stories, but it's honestly done quite well, and the romance subplot will at some point seem childish, but this is kind of normal. They're young teenagers, so don't get overly annoyed by it. Also, it's mainly there as part of and kind of in support of the plot, and this is definitely not a fantasy romance. There's also some underlying angst in the characters, which is quite nice, and it makes every character seem a little more normal and justifies their actions, once again lending to the moral questions posed in the book as well. Overall, it's genuinely a really good read. But whereas the plot in the book is quite intricate and detailed and clever, the film's plot is quite clumsy and oftentimes hinging on poorly established premises. It spoils itself at moments and kind of lacks subtlety in every aspect that the book excels at being quite implicit. So let's get started with section number one, which is, world building and what went wrong with the screenwriting.
Films are short. You cannot do everything. So I'm just going to explain how I think they could have recreated or gotten pretty close to the same fantasy world that's presented in the book, and also the same characters in the span of one film. This also includes having a functioning plot, by the way. So option number one, keep the initial context of the book, which means setting up the protagonists, Sophie and Agatha, commit to the school for good and evil, so as in like the actual school, what it represents in the book, the lore behind it, and maintain its baseline functioning, and then keep whatever the film does with the rest of the plot. So you kind of only need to keep everything up until page 75, so not even like a fifth of the book, and then the film could expand from there and do what it wanted with the plot. And then option number two, don't worry about the backdrop and introducing characters too much, but focus on the structure provided by the school's big events and the school's functioning, which definitely acts as a pillar. They act as pillars to the fantasy nature of the book. Sorry, really bugged out there. In all options, I think keeping Sophie and Agatha's personalities and characters as similar as possible to how they are in the book is really important, because the plot is very much dictated by these factors. A lot of the events in the book don't really happen to them. They either cause them or they actively participate in them. So it doesn't work as well without them staying the same. So let's start with option number one. Without even keeping the quite obvious structure of the book, simply keeping this context would have made the storyline more credible and allowed the film to better delve into the greater intricacies of the book. At the beginning of the book, we're told that every 4 years, two children past the age of 12 are kidnapped from Gavildon, which is where Sophie and Agatha live. This has been going on for 200 years. Every year, four storybooks simply appear in front of Mr. Deauville's bookstore, where he then copies them out by hand. The villagers realize in the stories there's a village that resembles Gavildon, which is where these fairy tales would start and then end, and then everything else happened inside the woods surrounding the fairy tale village, which coincidentally resembles the one surrounding Gavildon. And they know of the school for good and evil because a crest appears on 1 year's batch of books, which has the two swans, which is they're kind of like the symbols of the school. And then underneath it says the school for good and evil. And no one wants to be taken. No one wants to go to this school, as the blurb suggests. People would go into the woods to try and find the kids and would either be stopped by natural phenomenons, reach a village, only to find out that it was their own. And also, while this isn't in book one, we find out at the beginning of book two that women were being burned at the stake because they thought that witches were the reason why the children were disappearing before they found out about the school for good and evil. Like, the original context for the book is actually really dark straight off the bat. And basically, this village is being terrorized. It's being terrorized by the school. And then we have this very intense characterization that happens at the beginning of the book, which acts basically as scaffolding for the plot, because their characters are set up this way from the start. And as I said before, like, the characters are very important for the plot, and it helps make the evolution of their characters and their character arcs much more fluid. So we have Sophie, who is very self-centered and vain. She wants to go to the school for good because she wants to become a princess so she completes good deeds. And that's actually partly why she befriends Agatha. She's kind of Sophie's little project. And she completes these good deeds because she thinks that that's what will help her get into the school for good, even though they're basically a chore for her. And also, Sophie's perception of good is intrinsically linked to how beautiful you are. So she believes those who are beautiful are good. Sophie first became friends with Agatha because she believes Agatha will also, besides being a good deed, will also be taken to the school for evil as a witch because of Agatha's looks, the fact that she's very isolated and her manners. And because she perceives Sophie, she perceives different as being an indicator for impending evil. And she also wants a friend when she goes to the school. Basically, she's been planning to go to the school for years and is incredibly committed to her fairy tale. She even sleeps with a cuddly toy, which resembles a prince. That she sewed herself. Whereas Agatha doesn't go out, except Bruin finds her odd and thinks she's going to the school for evil. Even her mother thinks she's a witch. She's packed her luggage for her to be taken, and Agatha is just completely ostracized. And she's really just happy to have a friend, even though she recognizes that Sophie's treatment of her is often unkind or simply dismissive of her feelings. She likes Sophie because the attention and their mundane activities, such as walking together and squabbling, make her feel ordinary, and that's all she wants. And they are genuine friends, it's important to say. Like, they're actually friends in the book. The film was completely right to maintain that. Both of them feel as though the other one is the only person who truly makes them feel comfortable and understood. Even though Sophie's original motivations weren't exactly pure. However, in the film they didn't choose option number one. And so the context for the beginning of the story, that the school for good and evil and these kidnappings have been plaguing this poor village, is gone. So that entire fantasy element, which explains all of Sophie's actions and allows us to kind of explore Sophie's character and her ambitions. Also, the fantasy that explains Agatha and Sophie's, the context that explains Agatha and Sophie's friendship to begin with, it's gone. Additionally, you have completely different characters. They stand as equal in the friendship, rather than Agatha kind of wanting to hold on to her and Sophie's relationship more than Sophie wants to hold on to theirs. And so Sophie no longer looks down on Agatha. They're childhood friends in the film. And actually, besides Agatha having slightly different interests and dressing differently than Sophie, and Sophie caring a bit more about her appearance, they're rather average people. Although both of them still feel like they don't belong with Agatha being an outcast, obviously not to the same extent as in the book, and Sophie wanting more in her life. They're very watered down compared to their book characters. But the thing is, now Sophie's obsession with the school for good and her fairy tale ending no longer has the same steady foundation as it had before. She isn't egocentric and haughty, and the school for good and evil isn't common knowledge. Either one of those would help explain her actions later on, but they're simply not part of the film. And actually, the concept of her even going actually becomes really stupid. They go to Madame Deauville's in the film to look for some books, and she's found a crest on one of the fairy tale books, and she explains what it might mean, and Sophie's like, okay, I'm obviously paraphrasing, that's so cool, I want to go. And she writes a letter and puts it into the wishing tree, conveniently on the same day the school term starts, the day before. And then she actually ends up ripping the letter to the wishing tree, asking to go to the school after Agatha begs her not to go. And then, like, the reason why she rips up the letter is explained as she didn't want to wait for her life to magically improve. So instead, she simply plans to run away in the most unprepared manner possible. And so she literally, in the scene where she's apparently running away, she literally just has a basket. I don't know if I misunderstood this. I honestly thought I misunderstood this multiple times. Like, I've watched this film 3 times now, and every single time I was like, am I actually understanding this? So basically, she's literally just has a basket and no cloak when she decides she's running away into the forest, which technically she shouldn't be able to do, you know, in the book context. And then Agatha catches her and tries to get her to go back to the village, but apparently some wishes are too strong to take back. And they both get taken when A tries to stop her being taken away by the headmaster, and then by the Stymph, which is almost like this massive zombie vulture. And all of this, all occurs in one day. In the book, she's obsessed with the idea of having a prince. She sleeps with the prince's doll, for Christ's sakes. And having a prince and a one true love fits into what she has long perceived as her inevitable future. And that kind of translates later on to not only wanting Tedros, who's the main guy, but her also feeling entitled to him. And also, you know, the fact that she's self-obsessed and has been waiting to go to the school for all life explains why she gets really angry and doesn't want to leave a lot more than the film. Like, she's just discovered this place and suddenly she's supposed to be obsessed, which just it doesn't make that much sense. And what's odd about the film Paulie introducing Agatha and Sophie is that their first dialogue with one another alone would have sufficed to do it properly, even without references to the School for Good and Evil. So they could have not kept the concept, but at least kept that dialogue and then had the same characters by having this dialogue, and everything would have made just a tiny bit more sense. And so, you know, their attitudes in the film don't really hold up without the premise originally set in the book, as well as the characterization that occurs. And the plot, therefore, becomes a lot less stable and a lot less sensical. If the film had kept the context provided in the book and on the blurb, as well as highlighting some of the other characteristics of the school that we know from the start, as well as those already in the film, it would have made more sense and felt a lot more accurate to the book as well, without them having to then keep the entire plot. Let's discuss what happened and with option number two, which would have been my favourite option, though, if I had to pick. Because I also wish I didn't have to, but you kind of do in films, and it would be way too picky for me to want that or expect that. And of course, both options uphold the plot in their own way, so it's okay, it's whatever. Now is a good time for us all to take a moment of silence to mourn the way this film messed up what could have been the next Harry Potter. And I say that without insinuating that the book is a ripoff, because I didn't get that impression at all. And that's all I'm going to say on that, because I'm sure that that has been said multiple times. The book had that potential. That's all I'm saying. The book had that potential. Okay, but moving on, because I could talk about that for ages. The main structure of the book is based around three school events: the Trial by Tale, Circus of Talents, and the Snowball, which is usually Everball. It's called both. I'm not sure which one is the best way, which is the accurate one. But yeah. And then there's also survival classes and a ranking system. It's important to say, like, straight away, that they didn't entirely throw away these events, and these events definitely did help advance the plot, as they did in the book. The problem is that they're poorly handled, and therefore they lose a lot of their significance. Already, you can tell that the book was really cool. Like, it genuinely was. Like, not, I know that's a very simple way of describing it, but I think you understand what I'm saying, is that it was really cool. I really liked the concepts of the book. It was thoroughly enjoyable. I'm not going to talk too much about the ranking system, but it is part of the functioning of the Trial by Tale and Circus of Talents, just because it determines who is in the Trial by Tale and Circus of Talents, but it's not essential to the overall plot. I mean, it does give clues, and it is a core element of the school's functioning, though. So if you're going to do certain things, it would have been important to remember that it was thanks to the ranking that certain actions made sense. But it isn't mega relevant in the context of the film. They also have these surviving fairy tale classes, and there's three notable ones. In the film, they are only held in the good school, whereas the classes themselves are originally with both schools, and, as I said, about learning to survive in the real world when they leave the school. But there are three specifically important classes, and they are centered around the ability to detect good and evil. These three fairy tale classes are where you see the dynamics between characters properly play out and where we see the primary plot lines unravel. And this is most literally where the lesson good cannot be recognized by superficial references such as beauty plays out. And this is part of why the end result of this film is so satisfying, because it creates a more gradual build-up to, like, the result of the love triangle. But because this isn't really used to that effect, in fact, there's only one survival class and it's not centered around the lesson, some of the developments in the film feel kind of sudden and abrupt, especially those surrounding Tedros figuring out who his one true love is. And in the film, they use the one surviving fairy tales class to cut a corner in the world building, which is fair enough. But, you know, the loss was felt. So let's move on to the main events. The trial by tale is kind of the pivotal moment in the book. And it, you know, it's the first event. I'm doing this in chronological order. And just so you know, the surviving fairy tale classes all happen, the most important ones all happen before the trial by tale as well. In the book, the best 20 students out of both schools participate in the trial by tale, including Sophie. And they have to fight against each other and survive in the woods. And basically, the people who last until dawn win. And how they performed in the pre-trial competitions determined how long they had to spend in the arena. Sophie performed really badly, so she had to go in first. And based on their rankings after this trial, the class captain for both schools will be decided. The trial obviously gives them a lot more points. And usually they get points depending on how well they do in the classes. The pre-trial competitions aren't in the film, but they're also not in the book, so they didn't need to be. In the film, it's still really well done, and I think the fighting sequences are brilliant. And it is very, it does actually explain and develop the dynamics between the characters again. So it's not pointless, but as I said before, it's not like they don't try to use these elements, and it's not like the elements that they do keep in the fantasy aren't great moments of fantasy, because in principle and on paper they're already cool as concepts. It's just that they're not used to the same extent and the same effect, and just don't hold the same impact. In the book, Sophie and Tedros are going towards each other during the trial by tale because they both want to win and not get killed as well, and prove their love in doing so. But they're still competing with everyone else. And there are multiple combat sequences which I would have loved to see adapted that weren't in the film, and instead they use the trial by tale as a concept to only to prove whether Tedros and Sophie's love is real. Only the two of them go into the trial by tale, and they just had to find each other by dawn. So it completely loses all the subtlety in what it's trying to explain. And you don't get the full extent as to how the way the trial by tale plays out reflects on Sophie and Agatha. And also completely changes Tedros' plotline in a really cool way. Like, I say cool so much because there were so many times when I was reading where I was like, oh, this is fantastic. Genuinely. But yeah, it's so worth reading the book. I say this as someone who's definitely not meant to be the target audience. It's brilliant. It really is. Anyway, I'm sure you've already guessed that the combat scene was nothing compared to the book. But it was still well done. Like, the CGI in this film is actually really good. So in the film, you don't really fully understand why Sophie needs Agatha so much, and also why she sucks at the trial, which would have made sense if the ranking system was integrated, but it is not, and that's okay. They have a pass for the ranking system. And we don't get the full effect of Tedros only finding Sophie when Agatha joins her, which we would have gotten if they had the survival classes. I think what's quite funny in it, and why it's such a shame that they didn't have the survival classes, is that this forest is massive, and so the significance of Tedros finding them is also quite poignant. It's really good. I wanted to see it. Sorry, I'm not making much. This wasn't a well constructed last few sentences, but yeah. So I just feel as well that like the film really needed to do a lot more showing rather than telling, and the trial doesn't show this too much, but the other events do. I just feel like there needed to be more deepening of the characters in these events, and the events needed to not be there solely to advance the plot. The Circle of the Talents doesn't happen. I don't want to talk about it. You know, it's not like it's kind of really important. But yeah, it's just not there, so I'm not gonna go there. Also, we're just gonna move on to the snowball. As far as I'm aware, the Evers ball, the snowball, happens in 2 weeks into the school. There's such a poor presentation of time in this film that I don't know how to. It's terrible. And I want to use the ball to present my thoughts on the presentation of the main lessons and the morals of the story that you're supposed to take both from the film and the book. As I previously mentioned, there's how good you are cannot be determined through artificial means or measurements such as good looks. That's moral number one. There's also an even more complicated concept which goes with this, which is that intentions behind actions are important too when it comes to using good deeds as an indicator as to how good you are as a person. But I can't even remember that being referenced in the film. And also that's quite a philosophical question, so I'm not going to confuse everyone by mentioning it anymore. The second moral is no person is entirely good or bad. I'm trying not to spoil what actually happens as much as possible for those of you who have yet to read or watch this and would like to, but Sophie holds the first ever Nevers ball near the end of the book. And we have no perception of why the first Nevers ball is important in the film. The students of the School for Evil are people who were constantly told, probably by their parents as well because they come from villain families, that they can't have friends, that they'll never find love, and that they're meant to aspire to being completely alone for literally eternity, even in the afterlife. That is literally the concept of Nevermore, which is what they're supposed to be aspiring to. And in the book, they were actually having innocent fun, and the ball is so sweet and cute, and Hester almost cries over it when explaining the appearance of their ball set up to Agatha. By this time, though, the duality that we've started to see in the students from both schools has become very evident, and you actually feel really sorry for what happens next. The duality being that even though they're students at the School for Evil, they can have the same aspirations and compassion, desire for friendship, for love, as good, because they're all human. They both have the capacity, all of the students have the capacity to be both good and evil at the same time. Instead, the meaning behind this event just gets washed away entirely and forgotten because it has to be rushed, and because besides the fact that they're supposed to be evil, we know nothing about the students of the School of Evil. And none of their actions, because they're just not present in the film, help to kind of indicate that. Because it's not really explicitly said, but it is very much a part of the book. And the plotline that Agatha kindly spells out for us in one sentence, instead of letting the details events of the book speak for themselves, which is no one is fully good or evil, that's not how humans are, doesn't really appear in the rest of the characters, besides Sophie in a genuine way. Because little details such as maintaining the significance of the ball for their nevers were not taken in account I'm not even going to discuss the easiest thing they could have added to make it clear that duality is present in everyone. Not just because it's a bit of a spoiler, but also because it pisses me off too much. It's in the details, people. It's in the details. And actually, they end up having to be very explicit about this message, even though it's supposed to be a key factor in the plot and should therefore appear in the plot. And the same applies to the lesson, goodness cannot be measured through superficial indicators such as looks, which is central to Agatha's character arc. That one is spelled out for us only half an hour into the film, and then never properly built on or readdressed. Yeah. They admitted so much information provided by and in these trials by poorly handling them, that they had to reduce plot lines to moments of dialogue, essentially ruining their significance. Yeah, and these are the same pieces of information that keep the audience properly engaged, you know? And there's a real loss of impact caused by the ineffective use of that structure of the book. And it's a shame. There were behind the scene pictures of Sophia on Sophia Wiley's Instagram that showed some of the actresses playing good princesses in dresses that weren't shown in the film. So if there were scenes deleted, I would really like to see them just to see if the details were in those scenes. And I think that by keeping option number two, all the characters could have been better. So keeping the structure with the events, with the survival classes, and even potentially the ranking system. If they'd kept option number two, I think all the characters could have been better enhanced and fleshed out. I think Sophie and Agatha's personalities, and you know, their characters as a whole, which, as I mentioned when explaining option number one, are very important to the plot working and being good. They could have been gradually established through their actions and reactions to the events of the plot. As long as they'd kept this structure, everything still would have made sense, with light modifications to adjust what they would have had to cut out for time. It would have worked really well, obviously in my opinion, but I genuinely think it would. Without, as well, plot lines or lessons being too compromised or watered down. Even not including anything that constitutes option number one. Instead, you have this bland mishmash of bits of the book. You have the characters, but they're not as interesting. You have the school, but it's barely expanded on. And you have the same events, but they don't have the same impact. And you have the same lessons, but they're told to you rather than shown. Just to recap, because I know I've been speaking about this for a while now, and I promise that the other sections are not as long. Option number one was keep the initial context of the book, which involves like the characterization of Sophie and Agatha, and then committing to the school for good and evil and what it represents in the book, the lore behind it, and maintaining the baseline functioning of the school and the plot without like the structure, which then means that the film and what it does with the rest of the plot can kind of expand from there. And then option number two is don't worry about the backdrop and introducing characters too much, but focus on the structure provided by the school's big events because they act as pillars to the fantasy nature of the book, all while keeping Sophie and Agatha's personalities, characters, as close to their book counterparts as possible. Though the world building and the way they handled it is their biggest mistake. Yeah, their biggest mistake lies in the fact they committed to neither option, because not only does it make it poor as an adaptation, because as I said before, it's a very watered down tone, there's less tension, there's less lore to encourage people to have a continued engagement with the film outside of just watching it, but the film itself becomes very confused and shallow, it's no longer clever, and therefore grossly fails to live up to its potential and the one offered by the book. Finally, all that part on the world building, on the screenwriter's choices, that's done now. This second section is about how well the other elements in the film recreated the atmosphere present in the book, starting with the music choices. The actual instrumental music in this film was insane. Like, genuinely, Theodore Shapiro did an amazing job. It's absolutely incredible. It came across as very foreboding and menacing at times, but also functioned very well in the more lighthearted scenes. And I was listening to the soundtrack whilst writing up my notes for this episode, and Theodore Shapiro definitely understood how the book felt, and it would be worth reading it if you haven't yet after listening to a soundtrack all by itself. It's perfect. However, a big however, okay? you can't put modern music into a fantasy setting. It immediately pulled me out. We associate certain music with certain settings. That's why Taylor Swift worked in The Summer I Turned Pretty, because we're dealing with that generation and because it's in a modern setting. Fantasy and period dramas, unless they're in a futuristic setting or low fantasy, work best with classical music or instrumental music. More modern forms of music just don't work. I mean, if people have examples, I'd love to see them. But I think I wouldn't enjoy it either way. Plus, there are so many highly successful films that kind of serve as references to us in our minds. So we know what to expect when we hear classical music, when we hear instrumental music, because we already associate fantasy with those forms of music, and it eases us into the fantasy world. It makes it more believable. Also, using such well-known artists like Billie Eilish, Olivia Rodrigo, and not just Britney Spears, but Toxic by Britney Spears kind of comes off as an obvious, I keep on saying kind of, and I can't. Anyway, sorry. Sorry, I have to stop. I think I used it like 5 times in the last paragraph. Anyway. Sorry. Using Britney Spears' Toxic comes off as an obvious attempt to attract a certain audience, which comes off as a little cheesy, especially if you know the music and don't like it. I think, however, Who Do You Think You Are by Kiana, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but by Kiana Liddy and Cautious Clay was brilliant though. And it fit with the overall film. I think they understood the book as well. And it really translates Agatha's uncertainty as to whether or not she's good. And that's all the film needed at the end. It didn't need any other lyrical songs. I'm sorry. I absolutely lost it when Spaceman by Sam Ryder played at the end. I really like him, but I did audibly laugh. Yeah. I think instrumental music speaks for itself in fantasy, but also in film in general, you know, and this soundtrack had that potential and it is that good. I just don't think it was fully allowed to do that here. And this wonderful soundtrack ended up being a little dwarfed by the very contemporary song sporadically added in. So kind of mixed results. And then this attempt to modernize a bit shows in some of the choices when it came to the cinematography. Unless a film is trying to introduce an entirely new way of approaching a genre, I think you should probably stick to the trademark characteristics. It's possible to use some of the trademark characteristics of other genres in moderation, because sometimes it fits the theme, or because, you know, obviously genres intersect. But there were moments when The School for Good and Evil ended up looking like an old chick flick. The scene where Sophie enters with Dot, Hester, Anadil, and this other girl into the main eating area after their makeover, and they essentially just strut in with You Should See Me in a Crown by Billie Eilish playing and kind of look vaguely above the camera. It resembled every chick flick popular girl group entry, you know, with Mean Girls being the most obvious example. But to be honest, it's grossly overused in chick flicks. It has no place being in a fantasy film. It was awful. I couldn't stop. There were moments in this film where I was laughing, and I really shouldn't have been. This film is dark, not really a comedy, but it was funny to me. This was made worse by the camera focusing on Tedros staring at Sophie at different moments in this. It was a montage. And I'm not saying Tedros doesn't stare at Sophie in the book, but it was just the way it was done. And some of the scenes with Hester and Beatrix came on as very cliquey, with both of them appearing as the typical mean girl. This isn't to say the film was just cheesy at all, or that it was cheesy overall. The schools were gorgeously recreated. I loved what was going on with the makeup during the ball scene. Agatha's dress and accessories are the same as Cinderella, who also turned up to the ball alone. It's gorgeous, and I'm such a fan of the design choices. Does it really fit? Do the costumes really fit into what we typically see in fantasy? No. Do I think it really matters that much for this book? Also no. There were also some great moments, mainly where magic was involved, where you really felt the fantasy tension and threat that the magic posed. And it's just that the little things I just mentioned seem to kind of yank you out of the illusion. And to be honest, I don't think a film should need to be showing us magic for its audience to lean into the fantasy. We know that we're in a fantasy movie whilst watching Lord of the Rings, during the long shots of the actors walking across mountains, as well as when they're fighting against orcs. So yeah. Now I'm mainly done with trashing the film, so I'm going to talk more about the good stuff and what was well done, because I quite liked the film. And also, I'm not going to trash the film anymore, because anything I say is basically predictable. Now I'm going to give the film a bit more credit. I like to say that the main cast acted their asses off in this film, and I think the casting itself was brilliant. We got to see the newer generation of actors, Sophia Wiley playing Agatha, Sophia and Caruso playing Sophie, and Jamie Flatters playing Tedros. It's really nice to see them on screen. It's such a shame though, because again, the script doesn't give them justice, and I think if they made it closer to the book, they would have been brilliant. They would have been brilliant. And they had such a good cast. Like, Kate Blanchett was in there, Lawrence Fisher, and Michelle Yeoh. They had the actors to make something really good out of this. It wasn't a big issue that they didn't respect the original ages in the book, with Sophie and Agatha being 15 in the book and Tedros being between 13 and 14. Their age isn't a big deal, like, in the book. In fact, you kind of have to guess how old they are, roughly. It's not like the film tried to pass them off as younger than they are, because they didn't bring the age into the opening context. Plus, they're slightly more reasonable in the film as well. So it's not like they're adults having to act childlike. Would I have liked to see younger actors? Yes. But not in this film's plot, that's for sure. Unlike Sophie and Agatha, I liked film Tedros. And I would like to argue that he might be better than book Tedros. Mainly because book Tedros has some questionable values and behaves in some questionable manners, despite being a quite well-rounded character. I did like book Tedros. He's rather, you know, arrogant and righteous. He's very noble and committed to the people he loves despite his trust issues. Yeah, and his least likable traits make sense in the book, considering the traditional values he'd been taught and the world he's grown up in, and also because he's 13 and 14. He is a little insufferable sometimes because of this, but it's not overwhelming, and, you know, he's an overall well-rounded character. But film Tedros was very well executed. Obviously, he's not a 13 to 14 year old boy with parent related issues. But you want to know who book Tedros ends up with, because it is made important. Whereas in the film, sure, it's still made important, but you also want to know because it's Tedros. Like, he's actually very charming, and you understand why people want to be with him. So although he lacks the depth provided in the book, he came out better in my opinion. He's definitely the character that comes out the best thanks to the film's changes. And, sorry, bumped the mic there. And book two still holds up with this Tedros. As I said previously, costume choices were stunning. The makeup was very clever. I really wanted them to play around with Agatha's appearance a bit more in the film, because the beauty doesn't equal a good person message isn't really in the film. It's not a big deal. That's not costume and makeup's fault. Also, Sophia Wiley is really gorgeous. So it would have been really hard to make her look ugly, even if they'd made her dirtier and more unkempt throughout the whole thing. Even if they'd put her in uglier clothes, it would have been really hard. Otherwise, the recreation of the two schools was fantastic. I rushed to pick up my book to compare the map to the silhouette of the schools in the film, and it's so well done. The film... I love that I marked this down. I said, don't forget about this. The film also removed possibly my favourite, the most cringe and ridiculous childish scene of the book. So, which is when Tedros and Sophie meet in the forest as blue and pink foxes. I can't. Tedros Fox was described as being muscular and they almost kiss as foxes. They hold tails as foxes though. I lost it. Like, it was actually a rather important part of the book. Like, and I get that it's an important scene, so I think I'm supposed to have wanted it to be in the film, but honestly, I had to shut my book and walk around my room for a bit once I'd read that, and I think I would, and I think the people who had read the book would have found it hilarious. I still appreciate it not being in the film, because I think with everything else going on, I would have just had to stop watching it, at least for a bit. I would have had to leave it for a couple of days out of principle, because it was stupid in the book, but it would have been nonsensical in the film. It wouldn't have worked. So yeah, there's some positives. Okay, besides the script, everything, there was a lot of effort put in. Now I've explained what I would have changed, I am going to move on to what I would have added. Holt and Hester are very weak characters in the film, so there's little desire to pay attention to their potential backstories. But book one doesn't go into details as to what their backstories are. And I haven't finished the entire series yet, mainly because I don't want to muddle up the books. I did, however, double check, and they are important beyond this book and therefore beyond the first film. So what I'm proposing would be good. Also, can I just say, I'm about to do a massive side note, but can I just say, book Hester is so much more important, nuanced, and badass to the plot. Like, it's crazy how much more important she is. And Hort, justice for my boy Hort. Okay, he has a couple of iffy moments. He is creepy, okay? Where he is a little intrusive of Sophie's personal space. But none of the book boys are originally that great. But he delivers. He got to say one of the most romantic scenes I've read. Boy, does he put up with some crap too. So I decided to permit myself this one quote, as it's not a massive spoiler, but skip by about 30 seconds and you'll be good. Okay? Are you ready? Dad told me villains can't love no matter what, that it's unnatural and disgusting. So I definitely can't love, Hort said. But if I could love, I love you. I really do love those lines so much. Anyway, back to what would have been a good thing to add that isn't in the book. First off, not all book adaptations need to be television series. Give me some time. But it would definitely need to be a television series for what I'm about to suggest. Tedros, Agatha, and Sophie have very different but traumatic pasts, whilst Hort and Hester have well-known villain parents and hold decent roles in the plot. Hester's mother was a cannibal, but she was also burnt alive. Hort's father was Captain Hook, and although he's a villain and obviously told his son that villains can't love, he still gifted his son frog pajamas. Hort, Hester, Tedros, Sophie, and Agatha are those I would propose for this concept, just because it would be easier, but the opportunities are pretty vast among all the students. What I would have done for some angsty flashbacks of them when they were kids, all of them, I would have been happy if it was just one of them getting these flashbacks. For example, in the book, there's a moment as they pass by the graveyard during their surviving fairy tale classes where a magical creature is digging graves for the fairy tale princes and princesses and characters, where Hort reveals that although his dad has been dead for 2 years, he still hasn't been buried. In my ideal adaptation, preceding this revelation, there would be a flashback to a young Hort, who can't be much older than 13, receiving the news that his father has died, and consequently struggling to handle his emotions towards his father's death in a way that would have made him proud. without revealing too much, there are moments in the book that Hester is in the school for good, and one of the rooms in the school for good is made out of sweets, marshmallows, cake, and most importantly, gingerbread. Her mother chose to have her even at a very old age through magic. Here, we could have had a mother who deeply cared for her daughter despite being evil and trying to teach her how to be evil too. With Hester later having to bear witness to the murder of her mother or discovering her dead mother, etc. So rather than Hester being a caricature for evil like she is in the films, this or another form of flashback could be used to build on this arguably very complex character in the book who actually has a rather decent moral compass despite her evil aspirations. And we could have a backstory that portrays a girl whose childhood was robbed by those who are considered to be good, hardened by the world, and also someone who obviously doesn't want to suffer the same fate as her mother and all the other members of evil. Because they always lose. They've been losing for 200 years. And then obviously you have the fact that Agatha's been bullied and ostracized, Tedra's watched his mum leave his dad, and then watched his dad become a shell of the man he was, and Sophie witnessed her dad cheat on her mother, who then died, and then watched her mother be replaced by the woman he was cheating with. The fairies and the wolves hold a lot of significance in the book as well, and it would have been wonderful to play around more with them. Slight spoiler coming up. It could have been really cool to switch to their perspectives during moments where Agatha or Sophie feel like they might get caught by them, etc. Not in a cheesy, no one's here manner, as in the visuals would make the viewer seem as though they're literally seeing what the wolves or the fairies are seeing, and we could have just even one line of internal monologue, or even just the sound of a child sniffling as though they're crying, that would give us an implicit clue as to what they are. Essentially, I would have loved to add some darker elements, either in the main story or in flashbacks of the past, so that we, as an audience, could have a better understanding of what events have defined the characters in the book and then in the television series. I do recognize, however, that this would mean stepping up a notch in the maturity ratings, but considering the first book came out in 2013, a lot of the book fan base, which the success of this movie greatly relies upon, is currently old enough to take it. I'm not, obviously not asking for bloodbaths and really gory scenes, so I don't think it would be too much of an issue. And enhancing characters in this fashion makes them much easier to relate to. It makes us much more invested in them, in their happiness, in their well-being. And it also feeds into that idea that no one is completely bad or completely good, because it makes these characters more human and more realistic. And that's all I have to say. That's a wrap. That's the first episode done. I'm really sorry again for choosing such a stereotypical adaptation. I promise that the next one I will be discussing is very different. I'm not going to say if it's better or not, because no spoilers, but it is different. Yeah, I'm really excited. Next week, I have a friend coming onto the podcast, and we're going to be discussing one book and one film. The book and the film will be announced on the podcast social media platforms, so don't forget to check them out in the description of the podcast. I'm also really excited because I get to finish the book series, but mostly I'm really excited that I'm just doing this. So thank you for being here with me. I hope you have a wonderful day. Enjoy.